Welcome to Rails with Jason. Hey, I want to tell you about something. If you struggle with writing tests for your Rails applications, specifically RSpec tests, I have something for you. At my website, codewithjason.com, I have a whole bunch of articles on Rails testing that I wrote. Here's a couple examples of what you can find there. You can find a repeatable step-by-step guide to writing integration tests with Capybara. That's where I share my formula that I use every time I write a Capybara test that makes it pretty easy. There is the ultimate guide to RSpec and Capybara tests. And there's also mocks and stubs in plain English. These are just a few examples of dozens and dozens of Rails testing articles that I've written at codewithjason.com. I also have a free Ruby testing micro course that you can download. It's a four-part course, pretty easy to go through. Hundreds of developers have already downloaded the course. You can join them by going to codewithjason.com and downloading the micro course. I also have a book called Rails Testing for Beginners. The book can be purchased as just the book or the book plus a video package where I walk through the book and show you everything in the book. Again, all these things are available at codewithjason.com. Now on to the episode. Welcome to Rails with Jason. I'm here today with Colleen Schnettler, freelance Ruby on Rails developer. Colleen, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here.
All right. Did I pronounce your name right?
You did. It's a challenging one.
Okay. So you and I are going to talk about Raspberry Pi and that kind of stuff. But first, before we get into our topic, do you want to take a second and tell us about yourself a little bit?
Sure. My name is Colleen, as you already said. My background is in electrical engineering. So the first half of my career, I spent actually working on Navy ships and Internet of Things devices that go on those ships. And then I stayed home with my children for about 4 years. And gosh, I guess it was 3 or 4 years ago now, I learned Ruby on Rails and built a consulting business.
Wow. Okay, so I had no idea about the Navy ship thing that you had done. What kind of technologies did you work with when you were doing that stuff?
So I was in a group called the Machinery Control and Monitoring Division, which is kind of a mouthful, but what that actually means is we did the electronic monitoring of physical devices. So if you think about a ship, you have a valve, for example. Well, in modern ships, that valve is controlled by software. You don't need a person to go open and close a valve. So we actually wrote the software that opened and closed the valve, and of course, all the accompanying electronics that went along with that.
Okay. Wait, sorry. What are these valves for?
There's valves all over the ship for all kinds of different things, like release water, things like that.
Okay. I had no idea that ships even had valves.
Yeah. Yeah. These were big ships, right? But also, it was really neat. So we actually programmed something called PLCs, which are programmable logic controllers, which are exactly what they sound like. They control the physical signals going to the valves to open and close them. I also worked a lot on a fire detection system, and we actually had the same fire system they have in the casinos in Vegas. So I always used to joke if I wanted to move to Vegas, I could go, you know, work on their fire systems. But those were these really intricate arrays of physical devices that were controlled by this centralized system. And the software was actually proprietary to the devices. So I had to go, I think they were made by GE. So I had to like go to GE to take a class to learn how to program these devices.
Oh, wow. And your background is in electrical engineering, like your educational background, right?
Yes, it is.
Got it. Okay. So I'm just trying to piece together the history of all this. I gather you went to school for electrical engineering, did the stuff in the Navy with these devices on the ships controlling valves and detecting fire and stuff like that involved programming. And then somehow you transition from that into programming Ruby on Rails. Am I kind of understanding that right?
Yeah, a lot of the reason I got into Rails is because I think not only parents, but most people want flexible remote work. And after having my children, I really just wanted an opportunity to work from home. And, you know, working on Navy ships, I didn't really have that opportunity, although it was a great job. And so I actually started with iOS. So I taught myself, this was Objective-C, like before Swift came out, right? And I published an app to the App Store, and the app was not very successful. I think I sold 30 copies, but it kind of gave me the bug of like being able to work from home and make money. And I was listening. It was a baby tracker app. So it was like, I always got annoyed with my first child, how there wasn't an easy way to like be like, oh, he sat up, you know, he rolled over. Like I'd have to write it down. Like no one has time for that. So the app basically allowed you to track all your baby's milestones, take a picture and send a physical postcard to like anyone you wanted.
Oh, that's pretty cool. And so you had more success than most people, I think, because more than zero people downloaded your app.
Right.
How did that part of it go? Like getting it out there and having people use it? Was it below your expectations, above your expectations, as far as the traction it got and stuff like that?
So it was a little bit below my expectations. And I think my expectations were unreasonable because this was also the time when you were reading stories, you know, about the guy who made that shooty game app. It had like no graphics and he made $1 million. You know, this was like 7 years ago. So I kind of had expected it was going to do really well. And it got out there and I learned a few things pretty quickly. One was that image processing is hard. I mean, just dealing like with the images, because I was trying to process the images to send them out as physical postcards. So, you know, the quality wasn't very good. And I think that was a big negative. Also, I was using Kite at the time API to actually send the postcards. And so I didn't really understand their API that well. Then they ended up discontinuing their API. So that didn't really work out. But it was kind of an interesting introduction. Like I actually bought Facebook ads. So like just seeing the world of Facebook ads was really interesting.
What, like, just for context, what like time period was this? What year was this?
This was 2011, 2012, okay. Something like that. Yeah.
And
so quite a while
that,
ago.
How did that experience of buying Facebook ads go?
Well, it did not go well. It was interesting. I was impressed by how targeted you can make Facebook ads, you know, like mothers in their 20s or 30s who like, you know, X, Y, and Z. So I didn't really know anything about the Facebook ad world. At the time, I just did not have the time or energy to really dive into the metrics of click-throughs and all of that stuff. Like I had self-taught, you know, Objective-C. This thing is like, you know, kept together with duct tape, it felt like. So I was just trying to like make the app better. I didn't really have the bandwidth to also learn how to market it. So I kind of just let that project go. After I published the app, I thought that I would then try to get freelance work as an iOS developer. But again, this was just at the time. Like I just couldn't find anything that was a good fit.
Uh-huh. And then how did you transition from that to Rails? Or what was like the first thing that somebody paid you to do as a freelancer?
Ooh. That's a good question. No one has ever asked me that. I think the first thing I was paid to do as a freelancer, what was it? Oh man, I want to say it was it's a long time ago.
While you're thinking about that, I'll share the first thing that somebody paid me to do as a freelancer. This was in like 2008. I had been working as a PHP developer for like 3 years at the time. And, oh, you know what? As I started talking about the first thing I got paid to do, I realized that there was something else I got paid to do even earlier. This was 2007. I moved down to Austin, Texas because I wanted to get away from the cold weather of Michigan, and I also thought that Austin was where I was going to fulfill my rock star dreams, being the supposedly the live music capital of America.
Nice.
So I went down there and I stayed with this family friend. And this family friend also happened to be a programmer, but he was a really interesting guy. He had saved up a bunch of money and made himself, he saved up over $1 million just working as a programmer and putting away money diligently and putting money in the stock market and stuff. And he wanted me to write this program for him that had something to do with helping him with his stock related stuff. I don't really remember. I didn't really even understand at the time. I just kind of did what he asked me to do. But that was the first thing. I wrote this like tiny little PHP thing, and it was maybe like, I think it was like $500 worth of work. But he was like so happy with it. I remember that was a great freelancing experience. And it was like, you know, my first freelancing experience was a really good one. And then I had a bunch of really bad ones after that. And then some good ones too. But I think it's very common when you start freelancing to have a lot of bad experiences before you have good experiences, kind of just like anything, I guess.
So when you moved to Austin, did you have a job?
I did.
Okay.
I had been applying to stuff from Michigan, and it was kind of funny. I got one company to say, hey, we'll fly you down here for an interview. And so I kind of took that opportunity to line up a bunch of other interviews while I was in town. And for some reason, it seemed like people were a lot more willing to, like, it was a lot easier to get interviews when I was like, hey, I'm going to be in town for like 2 days. I can do this date or this date. You want to do an interview? And funny enough, the company that paid to fly me down there didn't hire me, but somebody else did. And so, yeah, I went down there with a job. Turned out to be one of the worst jobs I've ever had, and I only worked there for like a few weeks, and then I got a different job. But yeah, that's how that went.
Wow. When did you start freelancing full time?
That would be 2011. The summer of 2011 is when I first went freelance. I got fired from a full time job, and I had been wanting to go freelance for a long time. And I said, well, maybe this is kind of this is the trigger that I need. I don't want to go back to another job that I'm just going to, because I've never really like fit into jobs in general. Me and the system have always rejected each other. And so, you know, that was like maybe like a sign or whatever is how I took it. And so I started freelancing in 2011, and I've been freelancing on and off ever since then.
Nice. So my first thing I got paid to do, I remembered, it was a bug bounty program, not like a big fancy one, but it was just on a team that was like basically would pay you per issue that you squashed. So I feel like the first one, I think it was an N+1 query problem. I think that was my first like experience, and that was pretty good, but it did not pay well. So it was definitely not something like that was going to transition into full-time work. It took a while, obviously, you know, for me to grow into that level.
Got it. Do they pay like by the issue or something like that?
It was like $100 an issue. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Okay. And maybe it was like, so it was sufficiently time consuming that you couldn't really
get
a great effective hourly rate.
Yeah. And I feel like even now, like if I have to switch between projects, just like the context overhead of that, like I feel like I lose time. You know what I mean? Just by the time get your development, especially if you're using Docker, not to hate on Docker, but like by the time you get everything, your virtual machine and your Docker box and everything working, you know, it's been a little bit. So yeah. So for the bug bounty program, it just wasn't, it was too much churn.
Yeah. Yeah, I've experienced kind of similar things when I've like worked for a lot of different clients simultaneously and I have to switch among the different client projects. I used to think that the way to have security and stability as a freelancer was to work for multiple clients at once, but then I realized that that was just kind of a nightmare. And so now my opinion is that the way to have stability and security is to work for one client at a time, or at least as close to one client as possible, and have really strong marketing so that really strong marketing and good lead flow so that when you find yourself in need of your next client, it's easier to get your next client. That's how I look at it now.
Yeah, that's interesting. I was just having a conversation with a friend who's been freelancing for many years about this. People have different opinions. I have always taken what you first said, where it's like, oh, security means multiple clients. And I am now transitioning into shedding all of my clients to just have a really good relationship with one. And like you said, like do things to, you know, keep your name recognition and keep your pipeline open so you can get more when you need them. Because the switching, at one point I had four and it was terrible. Like I was working all the time. I got into this business so I could have free time. And, you know, I was working all the time. It was too many. So I tend to agree.
Yeah. Yeah. So our original topic that we were going to discuss is the Raspberry Pi. So tell me a little bit about that. And I'll just say for context, like I have two kids, ages 6 and 9, and me and my 9-year-old have been doing a little bit of programming together. We got a Raspberry Pi a few months ago. It's mostly been like us sitting together and me doing programming recently, because maybe I'll get deeper into this part of the story in a bit, but we built this program that simulates evolution, and there's like, we call it the world. And so there are these organisms in the world and they evolve based on their environment and stuff like that. So for that particular project, the kids have just been kind of spectating, and it's like, hey, look at what I added new to the world, boys. But before that, me and my 9-year-old had been doing some actual, like having him sit at the computer and do programming, which we need to get back into. But what kind of stuff have you done with your kids with the Raspberry Pi?
So I am so excited for this project, for like this whole, the whole Raspberry Pi. So I originally got into it because I was looking for a way to get my kids excited about software and hardware. And I thought it would be nice to include an element of hardware instead of just doing software. And so we got the Pi. And are you guys using Python or Ruby?
Python.
Yeah. So, okay. So I decided I wanted to use Ruby, which has been an interesting challenge because, as you know, like most of the libraries, I mean, Python has so many libraries and Ruby has like almost none. So the first thing, I was trying to get them excited about, I don't know, how the world works, right? Electronics and hardware and software and like, how does a light light up? So that's what we started with, is we started with, let's turn on and off an LED. And, you know, they thought that was relatively cool. Then we made a whoopee cushion, which was really exciting. So they really liked that. So all we did is I just made a huge like paper plate button. So it was fun because they were able to make the physical button. So I took two paper plates, and this was an idea I got online, connected them with like copper tape. I think I didn't even have copper tape. I think I used aluminum foil. But basically you put them together like a switch, like a huge button. And so you tie in a fart sound. And so when one of my kids sits on the paper plate thing, it makes a fart sound. And so that got everyone excited. Everyone liked that.
Nice.
And so I tried to show them like, hey, if we load this file, we can make this sound, or we can run this script and we can cycle through the sounds, you know, or we can pick a random sound. So I think that has gotten them excited. I mean, when we actually talk about like sitting down, like programming, I don't know that anyone is super into that part. As soon as we booted up the Pi, you know, the Pi has Scratch on it. And so have you guys played with Scratch at all?
No, I like opened the program just to see what it was, but that's all.
So as soon as my kids found Scratch, that's like all they wanted to do. Like they were like, wait, so I could write in a text editor on the command line, or I could play with sprites. Like they were all about the Scratch. So, which is great. Like that's, you know, that's great things that they're learning. It feels, you know, it's very event driven. So I think that was really good. But like the Ruby and the Pi stuff, only my oldest is into that. My oldest is 8. And my 6-year-old's not really interested. But I think the cool thing about the robot is it's like, we built a physical device that moves, and that's pretty cool.
Yeah. Yeah, that is cool. And I'm thinking as you're saying these things, like I'm getting ideas for things to show my kids, because it's okay with the like, I did some stuff with Elliot, my 9-year-old, where we like, what was it even? This was a few months ago. We made like a Ruby array, and the array had, I think it was like a list of our family members' favorite things. And you, the idea was we were making a game that would list the family members' favorite things, and it would show you one of the things and ask you whose favorite thing is that, and then tell you if you're right or wrong. Mm-hmm. So it would show you like heavy metal, and that would be, that's Oliver, the 6-year-old. He loves metal, which is really funny. His favorite band is White Zombie. yeah, that was the idea. And so I would sit next to Elliot and he would do all the typing. And it was really hard because you forget how much stuff you have to know and do in order just to get some words to appear on the screen. Like just typing, like just typing is so like, that's a skill that takes a long time to build. And like the knowing the names of all the different characters and stuff, like he knows what letters are and stuff, but like single quotes, double quotes, a lot of programmers don't even know the difference between like braces and brackets. And so like to teach a 9-year-old that stuff who is only like just beginning to get familiar with the world in general, like teaching them all those characters and stuff, like that's a big barrier. And so it's kind of it's a prohibitively long feedback loop between the time that you like, okay, we're going to try to achieve this result. Oh, but first you have to learn these million boring things before you can even get close. So that's a little bit tough. So I can understand how like something like Scratch might resonate a lot better with the kids.
Yeah, I really think so. And what my, because you're absolutely right, like the typing, you don't even think about that. Like I thought I would simplify things. So I would get like everything almost ready. And then I'd tell my son, okay, type these commands or type this line. And even that, you know, you're like, oh my gosh, like trying to be patient takes 20 minutes. They don't know where the keys are. The visual stuff really resonated more with my kids, and the physical stuff, like I said, the whoopee cushion was popular. And I don't really think, even though my son and I have done these three projects now, which would be the LED, the whoopee cushion, and now the robot, I still don't really think he understands what a loop is. Like kind of, sort of, maybe, but you know, I don't really think he conceptualizes it, but I think he understands that we, through, you know, stuff we wrote, we're able to make this happen. Like by putting wires in the right place and typing the correct commands into the computer, like we can make, I don't want to say magic, but I do, like we can make magic happen, right? Like we have the power. And like, I just think that's what we need. Is I just think we need kids to be excited about this stuff. Like about, I can build anything, you know? And it's funny, and you'll have to tell me if your son does this. So now my son's like, oh, can we, you know, add a sensor and make it turn around and add a remote control? And can it talk to us? And I'm like, eventually, but not today, you know? Like he's taken that to think we can do anything, which is kind of cool and kind of inspiring.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember when I was a kid, and the ideas that I had for stuff that I could build. Like, I remember this, there was this science fair, or no, not science fair, invention convention at our school.
Ooh.
Yeah, and my invention idea was way too ambitious. It was an electric mousetrap was my idea. So the idea that there was like a positive and negative side to it. There's like this tiny mouse-sized metal platform, and the mouse would step on it, and by putting its feet, some feet, you know, it would touch the negative side and the positive side and complete the circuit and shock itself to death. Which, you know, why did I feel the need to? I guess little boys love to kill things or whatever. But that was my idea. But it was way too ambitious. Like, how was I going to actually make that thing and make it work? And like, how did I think that I was going to, like, was I going to get live mice and test it on this thing? And so there was just this huge, huge disconnect between like things that I thought were going to be not only possible, but easy, mm-hmm. and things that I could actually do. And I remember, because my idea was so out there, the thing that I actually did ended up being so lame, and my dad helped me with it. There's this, okay, so you know that kind of problem where like you have the toothpaste tube and it gets down to the end and it's hard to squeeze out that little last part of the toothpaste tube. Here was my dad's idea. He took like a broken part. He took a disposable razor and broke the handle off, and the disposable razor handle had like a slot in it. And so he took the end of the toothpaste tube, the opposite end from where the toothpaste comes out, he took that end and like slotted it into the slot of the razor handle. So then you could like roll the razor handle up the toothpaste tube to like give you that hard edge to push out the last bit of the toothpaste more effectively. And it was a pretty dumb invention, you know, because it was just like, it was a broken razor handle and that was all there was to it. And I remember that I got a C, which I thought was a pretty generous grade for such a crappy invention that I didn't even do myself. So I feel like there's a lesson there, you know, that I was like shooting for the star. You know, there's that saying that like, if you shoot for the stars, at least you'll land
a moon. Like, if you shoot for the moon, you'll land among the stars. That
yeah.
one.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah. it's like, I shot for the moon and I landed like on the ground, you know, which is probably, it's probably more closer to the truth than that saying of landing in the stars. So all that's to say that like, yeah, I think kids often like, they'll think of projects that are just way too ambitious. So yeah, I guess I don't know where to go from that, but like projects that are like reasonably challenging are probably the way to go, I guess. I used to have this Lego Mindstorm set. Have you ever messed with that at all by chance?
Yeah. I feel like my freshman year of college, we used that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Just for fun or in a class or what?
No, it was in a class. It was in some freshman engineering class. We had to use it.
Yeah. Yeah. At what college freshman would have enough money to buy a Lego Mindstorms thing?
Mindstorms.
I didn't. I definitely didn't. Yeah, that was fun. That seems like a good thing for kids because it has like pre-made projects that you can just like follow the instructions and then get the intended result.
So that is true. But I feel like, so part of the reason we didn't use a kit for our robot, and part of the reason we did that is because I think the kits, and it depends on the child and how interested they are. But like, I sometimes feel like the kits make it seem too easy. Like the kits extrapolate away all the pain of it. And so like, for example, I'm coaching a robotics team at my son's school, and we're using the Dash robot. Have you seen the Dash robot?
No,
it is. So cool. It's this little blue robot and it's controllable via an iPad, and it has, so you have the physical robot and like the iPad has a touchpad, trackpad on it. And so anywhere you move your finger, the robot will go.
Okay.
So it's incredibly responsive, but it makes the whole process seem so easy. Like, oh, I'm just going to make this robot that does whatever I want it to do with my finger. And I kind of want to be like, that is an amazing product, but that was a team of who knows how many engineers who made that product. Like, you have to understand the basics to build anything. So like, our robot is so, I mean, it's cool, but it's kind of pathetic, right? Like, I can make it go right, left, and forward. It goes really slow. But I think like, we didn't use a kit, and I think that kind of showed him like, this stuff is hard, but not impossible. And some of the things make it like, they just make it seem like it's too easy. And I sound so bad. Like, I kind of wanted us to suffer through it, but I kind of just want to give people the impression, I think today, that this stuff is easy. right? You could take this on with like learning to code. There's like 1,000,000,000 websites that are going to tell you it's easy. And it's not easy. Like, it's worth it, but it's not easy. So anyway, that's why we built the robot without a kit. And I think there's value in both. Like I said, we're doing the dash at his school so he can actually see like, this is how awesome it could be if you had the time to devote to it. And this is how hard it is just to get to like stage one of building that kind of a device.
Yeah. Yeah. I can appreciate what you're saying. And I agree that there's value in like doing that really like fundamental, difficult stuff so you can see what's involved. And I remember there was this one occasion in a calculus class in college where like, what's that formula for like the volume of a sphere? It's like 4 pi r cubed.
Pi r cubed. Like I think so.
And it seems so arbitrary. It's like, where'd the 4 come from? And you know, like how did they come up with it? And I remember one day they took us through and like actually showed us how you arrive at that. And I was like, whoa, like this makes sense now. Like I can understand how somebody like went through some certain steps and then at the end of it, they arrived at that thing. So there's definitely value in like seeing not just like the, what's the word for it? Like the whole like put together thing that's made up of the building blocks. Like there's a time when you want to like stand on the shoulders of giants and like not reinvent the wheel. But sometimes it's good to reinvent the wheel so you can understand how that wheel was invented.
Yep, I agree. Like, I totally agree. And I think with kids, I think, like I said, it depends on the kid too. If the kid's not already excited, then making them go through like the longer process might not be the best choice. But I just think about this, like kids today are learning about electronics and programming, you know, at 8. So I just think the possibilities for what they're going to be able to create are, you know, endless. I'm excited for it to see, like, as they grow up, as this generation grows up, like, I'm really excited to see what they create.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's a lot more like building blocks available. And things like the Raspberry Pi that like you and I didn't have when we were their age. So tell me about this robot. You've mentioned the robot a few times. I don't really know what the robot does yet, though. I think I might have seen, like, you tweeted about it. It's like this green thing. Was I seeing the same thing?
It is a green thing. So this is so fantastic. So my public library has a 3D printer you can use for free, which is amazing. You just have to pay for the materials. So basically what we did is we got 2 stepper motors. We 3D printed a little body and some wheels, and we hooked the stepper motors up to the Pi, and like all the motors are controlled via the GPIO.
What's a stepper motor?
So stepper motors are different. So you have DC motors, which are your normal motors, which you just turn on and they stepper motors, you actually program per step. So I think it's 5. I think in our motor, it's 512 steps. I think I'd have to double check that per revolution. So the benefit of stepper motors is you can have really fine control in terms of turning. But they're a little bit harder, depending on who you ask, they're a little bit harder to use because you actually have to program a step sequence. So there's 4 pins. So each pin has to have a specific high or low value, and you have to program them in sequence in order to get the motor to turn.
Is that the same thing or something different from a servo motor?
Oh, I don't know.
Okay, I don't know either. Because yeah. My understanding of a servo motor is it's something that like, so what you use the term DC motor. I hadn't heard that before, but that's the kind of motor that you just like turn it on and it spins, and you turn it off and it stops spinning and you can't really control it. My understanding of a servo motor is you can like tell it to spin completely around once or something like that. I don't know if that's the same thing as. Wait, what was this? It's stepper motor.
Stepper motor. Okay. Yeah. It sounds the same, but I'm not 100% sure.
Anyway, you have the stepper motor, and then you used a different term that I didn't know what it was, like DC. It was like four letters. It was something that was hooked up to the robot.
Oh, the GPIO?
GPIO. What is that?
Right. So that's the general purpose input output pins on the Pi. So a lot of the motors, it looks like you just connect, you know, power negative and positive and run a pulse width modulation through it to control the motor. So ours is different. Ours has the four pins on the general purpose input output of the Pi that then connect to my motor. And then I excite each pin in a specific sequence in order to get the motor to turn.
Okay. I'm trying to digest all this. The GPIO. So the GPIO is something that's on the Raspberry Pi?
Sure. So our Pi has several pins, and there's a set of pins, I don't know how many, that are called general purpose input and output. So I can use those for either input or output. So in my code, I specify that I want them to be output. I specify that they start high or low. I'm sure I start them all low. And then I turn them on in specific intervals.
Okay. And those are connected to the stepper motors. Is each one of the stepper motors like a wheel?
So yeah, it's small, right? It's like an axle, more like an axle. And the stepper motor, when you buy them, the cool thing is like this whole project was really cheap. They're like $5. I mean, they're very inexpensive. And so they have a tiny board on them, which they come with. And so that board has four pins that I can plug into, and each sequence will rotate my, which is basically an axle. So the wheel slides onto the output of the motor. It's like a physical, you know, device that I can slide my wheel onto, and it turns, and that will turn my wheel.
Okay. And the GPIO thing, is that like, that didn't come with the Raspberry Pi? You had to get that extra?
No, that's just the pinout of the Pi. Like the Pi, I have a 40 pin Pi, I think. So my pinout on my Pi, it's on the Raspberry Pi.
Can you explain like these pins? I don't know what that part is about.
So that, I'm so excited you asked me that question, because I'm giving a talk at RubyConf about this. And the first half of my talk is going to be about electronics. And I was asking some of my friends who, you know, have 20 years experience in the field, if they knew how to wire up a breadboard, and they were like, no. So I will cover all these things in my talk.
So
the board comes with a set of pins. I want to say it's 40 pins, but I'm not 100% sure. So the way that's arranged is 2 pins wide and 20 pins down. And each pin is assigned a number. And each number explains what that pin does. So when you buy a Pi, or you can look it up, you have what they call a pinout. And the pinout will show you each pin and what it does. So you're going to have power, and you're going to have ground. You're going to have input and output and some other things. I think on my Pi, there's like some pins that are specifically say they can do pulse width modulation and things like that. When you connect it, you have to look at your pinout of your Pi and look at what you are connecting to, whether it's a breadboard or whether it's another, another device, and you have to align the pins. So in programming, in your actual program, you would say, for example, pin 7, 8, and 9 are going to be output pins. They are going to control a motor. And if that is the case, you first have to make sure that pin 7, 8, and 9 are GPIO, so they can be used as output pins, and then you would connect them to your motor controller board, and then you, in software, tell them when to go high or low, and they will control your motor.
Got it. Okay. I think I kind of understand. Okay, so you have, and is it just like, so I can imagine like these rows of pins. You said it's like 2 by how many or whatever?
20, I think.
Okay. Like I've seen things that I don't know anything about hardware. I've seen those things on computer motherboards and stuff where it's like the pin thing, and you can plug some like thing that has the ribbon coming out of it.
Yeah.
I still don't understand what this GPIO is. The GPIO like a single thing, or is it, can you explain that?
No.
Again?
Yes. So when I use the term GPIO, I'm just referring to a set of individual pins in the pin array. So it's just specific pins in the pin array. It's not all of the pins on the pin array. It's just certain numbers. And you just have to look at your pin out to know which numbers those are.
Got it. And like certain pins on the Raspberry Pi have certain like built-in capabilities?
Yes. So the way I'm using them is I program them to be low, which is 0 volts, or high, which is high volts. And by high, I mean 5. But I know that there's also, like, if you were going to do a DC motor, which we talked about earlier, I'm pretty sure there's a what they call PWM, which is pulse width modulation, which is how you sometimes will control a motor. Like, I think there's a specific pin for that. I haven't tried that. But you just have to be cognizant. If you don't buy a ribbon cable, side note, I think you can buy a ribbon cable for the Pi. I think I might have regretted not buying one because I have like 20 things connected and you're like, wait, which one is this? But yeah. And then, you know, you just use each pin for whatever you're doing with it in software.
Got it. And so if you didn't have a ribbon cable, so I'm imagining you had like four stepper motors. Is that right?
Two. We only had two.
Oh, two stepper motors. And so how did those stepper motors connect to the pin array, or did they connect to the pin array? Is that how that worked?
Yes, they do. So I have jumper wires. So I have like individual wires that are each a different color. And we had to connect each pin on the Pi via jumper wire to the motor controller board on the motor. So if you look at my Pi, it's got like 20, because it's got 4 for one stepper, 4 for the other. I've got power and ground. I think I also fed power and ground to the stepper motors from the Pi. So I've got like 20 wires coming out of that pin array.
So how long did this project take of like getting this robot thing working?
I don't know. How long? I think the hardest part was just getting like up and rolling, you know, just kind of getting going. And using Ruby on the Pi is, I don't want to say not ideal, but it's not really, I mean, it'd be much easier if we had used Python. I feel like if we had used Python, we would have been done in like 15 minutes, right? But we didn't. So I actually wrote all the for loops to control the stepper motor. And so I have like the actual sequence of the pins in like a nested array in my code, right? So it's like when you step through, it's like 0, 1, it's like 0, 1, 0, 0, 0, 0, 1, 0. So I have this sequence, this nested sequence array that I then loop through to excite the motors to get the motors going. So figuring that out took quite a while. I want to say, a couple weeks. You know how it is with side projects, you never have the time for them. So once we actually sat down and dedicated some time to it, we got it working. But, the interesting thing is like when you're building physical devices, I think especially as software engineers, we so often forget about the physical pieces. Like, for example, the first battery pack we had was maybe 4 inches long, 2 inches wide and 2 inches thick. And it was too heavy for the power that we had. So the wheels were just spinning out under this little body. So things like that, like we just didn't have, it was just lots of little stuff. Like we didn't have the right size screws to actually screw everything together and, you know, things like that.
Yeah. Yeah. It involves like multiple different disciplines. You have the programming part of it, the physical, what you might call a mechanical engineering part of it, and then what you might call the electrical engineering part of it. And I'm only 1 for 3 on like any skills in those areas. So yeah, however long it took you, it probably would have taken me like 3 or 4 times as long to get all that figured out. So at the end of that, you have this robot with 2 wheels that, what can it do?
It goes forward, right, and left.
Okay.
That's what it does.
Well, that's something. Yeah. And then obviously that is like, that's a win under your belt that you can like, then you can go do another project that's like slightly more complex than that and so on.
Yeah, I think so. Like I said, I think just like using Ruby, like Ruby doesn't have the libraries Python has for the Pi. So that has been a great learning experience in of itself. And yeah, like, so our robot doesn't do a whole lot, but I think my son is really excited about it. He thinks it's the coolest thing ever. So I think like just showing him that we can do this in a couple hours, you know, of our free time is really inspiring. And yes, if I can find the time, our next step is we want to add an ultrasonic sensor. So it won't run into things. So we'll see how that goes. But that's the next thing we want to try. So we can just keep adding to this robot, right? And see what we can build with it.
That's pretty cool. Yeah, I remember when I had the like first generation Lego Mindstorms thing when I was like 12 or something, and I built this Lego robot that would go forward and it had a touch sensor on the front. And if it would run into something, it would back up and turn and then go forward again in a different direction. And it only kind of partway worked, but that was kind of a fun project. Okay, I maybe want to transition now because, let's see, we have only a few minutes left. You've been working on I've seen some tweets and stuff that you've put out about this. You've been doing some Rails screencasts. Can you tell us about that?
Yes. So I started doing screencasts. My goal is to do a complete full course on Rails. And I'm working on getting a website up, which is going to be codewithcolleen.com. But right now they're on YouTube. So it's a really fun project. It's really fun for me to kind of revisit these things that have become, you know, kind of somewhat second nature you don't really think about. So I'm trying to revisit some things and make a complete course so people with a little bit of knowledge, like I don't show you how to install Rails. I don't explain data structures. I'm kind of taking that approach that a lot of other courses that I took that I enjoyed, which was just build something, like just do something. And I think it's a little bit harder in Rails than JavaScript. Like you don't kind of have that gee whiz, oh, I can make this cool thing. So that's why I decided I'm going to try to do the whole course because I didn't feel like there was enough of that content out there when I learned Rails. So I'm hoping I can provide some content for people who are learning, who have maybe read Michael Hartl's book, but they're not sure what to do next. You know, teach some stuff.
Can you think off the top of your head of any examples of things that like you wished had been out there as far as educational resources when you were learning Rails, but you couldn't really find?
Yes. So the thing I really struggled with was there's a lot of beginner content, right? If you are just getting started, there are a myriad of websites you can go to get started. So what do you do after you've done Code Academy, after you've read Michael Hartl's book, after, you know, you've done some courses on Treehouse? You're good enough to build something, but you're probably not good enough to get paid to build something. And that I found was a really hard gap to cross from like, hey, I can build a to-do app and a grocery list to, oh, who's going to pay me to build something? So that's why this course that I'm working on, it's not going to be crazy long because time, but I want to do some things like how do you send text message from an application? How do you use Devise for a model that's not users? How do you override your Devise views? Like just things that I felt like weren't really accessible, you know, for that kind of, I just graduated, you know, from a boot camp or I'm ready to get paid, but I need to learn a little bit more.
Mm. Yeah, that seems like a really good idea. I've long thought that it would be nice if there were more resources around, like, there's these things that you have to do in production applications that aren't really taught a lot, like things that came to mind for me. I think I might even have a list somewhere file uploads, which I know like you gave that talk on active storage, but that's like a whole, like that's an area that has a lot of depth and complexity to it. And it's kind of a mundane thing. I was going to say nobody gets excited about file uploads, but maybe some people do, maybe you do. But like that's something that's, it's hard to find. Even like active storage itself, like when I go around searching for stuff, there's a lot missing, and like I often have to do like kind of hacky workarounds just to get it working. And like if I'm having that much of a hard time with that, I can only imagine people who like are just starting with Rails, what kind of a time they have with that kind of stuff. There's probably way more things like that than like one person could even make a course for. Like deployment is another thing. Like I've had a lot of difficulties with like putting Rails on AWS, and I've like,
haven't we all?
Yeah. And I like a couple years ago, I wrote this like super long blog post about how to put Rails on AWS. And it's just crazy how much is involved. And I'm working on a tool right now to make that easier. What other kind of stuff is hard when you first get started? SQL is another big thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think there's just lots of that stuff.
Yeah. That's fertile ground for, and yeah, there's, even though the internet is huge and there's a lot of stuff out there, there's still like today isn't, I think there's not quite as much as what is needed around that. Like you said, if you get through like Michael Hartl's Rails tutorial, there's still a lot of stuff that you need to learn before you like are, like you said, like you're good enough to build something, but not experienced enough yet to get paid for something. There's a lot there.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. Okay. And so people can find that it's, you said it's not up yet, but soon it will be codewithcolleen.com.
Yes. Yep.
Okay. Okay. Well, great. The question I always ask people at the end is, where can people find more about you online? Do you want to share Twitter or anything like that?
Yeah, I'm on Twitter as Leanie Burger, which was my AIM screen name like back in the 90s. I have no reason for having that. Anyway, Twitter at Leanie Burger. And as I said, hopefully I'll have my website, codewithcolleen.com, up.
All right. We'll make sure to put all that stuff in the show notes. Colleen, thanks so much for coming on the show.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.